Howdy folks, today we're going to deep dive into where photography is going in the future. With all the changes that have happened over the past 20 years from film to digital, AI, etc., what is the future of photography? Welcome to Camera Shake, where we bring you the insider scoop on all things photography and videography, giving you a unique opportunity to stay ahead of the curve. We spend literally hundreds of hours interviewing some of the most renowned photographers of our time. In fact, and I mentioned it only just last week, it was 209,233 seconds in 2023 alone. That is legitimately nuts. That's a lot of hours, actually days. As always, I'm your host, Kirsten Nuts, and before we get into it, I've got one little thing to ask of you. I've noticed that over 65% of our viewers on YouTube and listeners on audio and not subscribed to this channel. And that's a shame. You can really help us out by hitting that subscribe button. It'll help us get even more amazing guests on the show, although that's probably not even possible. But, you know, it's just one click. It'll take a mere second. Just hit that thing and subscribe. It'd be amazing. Thank you so much. Now, without further ado, though, let's give it up for today's special guest, the man who knows everything there is to know about trends in photography, the president of Bedford Cameras and Video, and competition-level angler. Give it up for Bedford's very own Austin Pittman. Austin, man, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm very impressed with your fishing skills, by the way.
Oh, thank you. That's kind of my stress relief, you know, away from work. So,
yeah, I bet. I mean, you know, it looks like, from what I can tell, Bedford Cameras, you guys have a busy program. I mean, you've got, you know, you've opened new stores. You've got lots of educational stuff going on as well. That I find super interesting. And I really want to talk to you about the state of the industry in 2024, of course. But before we get into that, if you could just give our listeners and our viewers a basic, broad helicopter view of what Bedford Cameras and Video actually is, especially for us Europeans over here.
Absolutely. So in 1974, Stan Bedford opened the first Bedford Camera and Video. So this year is actually our 50th anniversary in business, which is pretty awesome. Started with one little store, you know, and just kind of been expanding ever since. We're up to five stores now in Arkansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma. So kind of central United States. We've got a big web presence, so we sell a lot. You know, our e-commerce store is a big part of our business. I started with Bedford's in 1998, so it's been about 26 years. I was a college student at the University of Arkansas and needed a part-time like job to get me through my senior year of college, and went in there and applied. And you know, 26 years later, here we are. So,
and you've made it all the way to present. Is there any further to go? I think that's it, isn't it?
I think that's about it. Yeah. Jason Bedford is the CEO, so he's one step ahead, but I think I'll just pretty much stay at the president level.
So. Phenomenal. I mean, 26 years, that's a long time in the photo industry. I mean, let's talk about some of the changes that you've experienced. I mean, 26 years ago, I bet, well, it must have predominantly been film.
Oh, it was almost all film. Almost all film cameras. You had the Canon Elan II. You had the first Rebel, you know, the Canon film Rebel G. When I started at Bedford's, we had one digital camera in the store. It was a Sony Mavica, the original Sony Mavica, recorded on the little 3.5x5 floppy disks, 640 by 480 resolution. You could get like 17 pictures on a floppy disk. So you had to carry around this bag full of floppy disks so you could take 17 pictures and then pull out another one. So, and it was like $1,200 for that camera.
Yeah. And just imagine where we are now, you know, isn't that incredible?
In a really short amount of time. I mean, from 1998 when I started, I mean, that's about when digital really started taking off and started becoming big. And, you know, for the first couple of years, it was mostly film and just, you know, you had the Mavica and then you had the next Mavica and it used a CD instead of floppy disk. And then it kind of went to the memory stick, memory cards. And then you started getting all these other brands kind of jumping in. But really from like 98 through like 2002, it really, in that short amount of time, there was a very big conversion. And then by like 2007 or 2008, it was almost all digital. I mean, it did not take long for that digital phenomenon to take over.
And of course, it's created some dramatic change in the whole industry. Some of the biggest names that would have been completely unthinkable that ever disappear have completely disappeared. Your Kodak comes to mind,
Ritz
for example.
Camera, Wolf. Oh yeah, Ritz Camera, Wolf Camera, Kodak. And if you think about, the change in the industry, I mean, there was so many back when I started at Bedford's. Obviously, film processing was a huge deal. And almost every corner, it was like Starbucks now, like almost every corner you'd have a film processing lab. And it was just a little, 500 square foot building with a processor and a printer. And, it was very, very profitable. So you had your Walmarts of the world and the Walgreens. And I don't know, in England, I'm not sure what you guys have, but I'm sure it was the same thing. All the drug stores, all the big retail stores, everybody was developing film. So there was tons of it. You go into your local Walgreens and they've got 1,500 square feet designated for film developing and camera sales. Same thing with the Best Buys and the Walmarts. I mean, everybody was developing film. Well, then the big digital camera boom hit. And that was for a long time, for like 4 or 5 years. I can't remember exactly, but for 4 or 5 years, digital cameras were the number one gift in the world. Like, everybody wanted digital cameras and everybody was buying them. And so, there was several years that, I mean, it was just, we were selling everything that you could possibly get. You'd have a Black Friday and it was like the Black Fridays of, that you hear about in all the big box stores. I mean, you would have people lined up the door and you'd have six salesmen across the counter, and each of them would be selling two or three cameras at a time. Like, it was nuts. And this is very broad, we can get into it deeper, but so you went from the film days, then you went to the digital camera where everybody was buying it, and we just couldn't, you couldn't sell them fast enough. And then the smartphones came out and kind of took that entire point and shoot industry almost away, to the point now, I mean, there's not very many point and shoot cameras out anymore. You got some of the, the 1-inch sensor cameras that are for somebody that wants a little bit better quality and stuff like that. But, it's been a huge swing from film to digital camera, huge giant explosion. Now to the point that most of the cameras that we're selling are upper end, Nikon Z8s and Canon R6s. And, I mean, it's just most of the people that walk in our door now that are looking for cameras are buying, real cameras, not just a point and shoot.
And that must mean that's basically, the sort of smartphone revolution must have sort of really like drained away the sort of the lion's share of your business. I mean, I'm just imagining this, correct me if I'm wrong, but I imagine that this point and shoot market would have been sort of the biggest part, like the base of the pyramid almost, as far as sales. Yes. Is that right?
It was. The camera industry, like the whole electronics industry, it's very, the profitability of selling a camera is very, very minimal. A lot of people don't realize that. They'll come in and say, hey, I want to buy this Z8, and hey, I'm buying a $3,500 camera from you, or whatever the price is. And yeah, well, you're buying that $3,500 camera from us and I'm making like $178 on it. Like, the percentages are very small. So yes, as far as like the gross volume of our business, it was, and I'm not going to say it didn't hurt, because it did. I mean, that was a huge, that was a huge part of our business. But it was not the profitable part of our business. So, we had to go to some other directions and come up with some other things to sell. And you mentioned the classes earlier, there's just a lot of different things that we've had to do over the years to recuperate that profitability.
And that's really, that's true for a number of different businesses. Before we went live, we had a chat, we're talking about the fact that, I used to be a musician. I've seen the exact same thing happening in the music industry, or in music retail, let's say, with the advent of the internet, for example, like physical music stores fell by the wayside. you know, by and large. Now, I remember, you know, back in the day, I used to like teach in stores. I used to have friends who would run music stores and whatever, instrument stores. And, you know, the story was always the same. They always used to say, like, well, people come in, they try out a guitar, then they go and find it cheaper online, and I'm not making a sale, you know? Like, I'm just displaying, I let people try out my products, and but they're not buying, you know? And so, and I, you know, I remember, actually, this is a really good example. So I used to work for this, I used to teach in this little music store, and this is really a music store from a different time. Like, half of the shop floor was sheet music, right? And that was at a time when everybody wanted to play the guitar and rock out, right? And the internet was a thing. And, you know, we used to, and the owner was a little bit older, and we used to say, like, man, get rid of, nobody's buying sheet music. Like, get rid of that stuff and, like, put guitars in there or something, you know? It's just, you know, it doesn't make any sense. Like, I just, but probably more than 50% of the shelf floor, probably maybe 70% of the shelf floor was just taken up by shelves and shelves of sheet music, you know, Chopin, whatever else, you know, that he'd flog for like a buck or something. You know what I mean? It just wasn't, it wasn't worth it. And everything went online at that time. You know, the big sort of music retail websites started to spring up. And, you know, I remember saying, like, you gotta join that. You know, you gotta go online and sell online, because the world is your oyster, basically, and you're not just selling to people in our little town, you know. And he just, in the end, he just went, well, I'm too old for all this. I think I'm gonna call it quits, you know.
Yeah.
And
well, same thing with our industry. You know, it's that same time period that, you know. So I graduated high school in 95, graduated college in 99. And I remember taking a college computer class, and the instructor, you know, this is back in dial-up days, you know, and she's like, the internet's great. There's so much information on there, but you have to be patient. You know, you go and you click on a page and then go, you know, go do something, go grab a snack, go grab something to eat, come back, click on another page. There's a lot of information, but it takes forever to access. And, you know, I mean, that was 25 years ago. Like, it's, you know, it feels like it's 100 years ago now. I remember being in high school and people talking about this World Wide Web, information superhighway, like this thing's going to change the world. You know, it's not, it hasn't been that long. But when I first started working for Bedford's, there really wasn't, like, B&H is our biggest, you know, superstore, camera superstore in the States. And I remember when I first started, there wasn't really a B&H website that you went on and bought stuff on the website. They had a big catalog that they would send to everybody. And, you know, 4 or 5 times a year, they'd update this catalog and send it out. And so it was catalog sales instead of internet sales. So the same time we've seen this giant digital camera explosion, which obviously they're related, but you also have, you go from just having the Walmart that's, you know, 2 miles down your road and the Best Buy that's 5 miles down your road as your only competition, to now everybody that sells a camera in the country is your competition. And that's happening the same time this digital camera thing is happening. And so it's been amazing how much it's changed.
And I'm pretty sure that
you've had to do business.
Yeah. I mean, if you could have taken, like, your 20-year-old self and time traveled forward to 2024, I bet you would barely recognize the store as it is now, or the business as it is now.
It's a whole nother world. And it was very interesting, because when I started, it was, you know, the photographic industry in general, there wasn't a lot of excitement. You know, they were coming out, Canon would come out with a new film reel every 5 or 6 years. So it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like, well, and today it's kind of slowed down again. But, you know, there for a while when the digital camera boom was going on, they were coming out with new models every year or every 9 months. And so, you know, once somebody would go from their Canon AE-1 program and they'd upgrade to autofocus and go with the Canon T70, and then they'd wait 10 years and then they'd buy a Rebel G, and then they'd wait another 10 years and they'd buy the Rebel G2. You know, like, it just... you didn't have the influx of people coming in there and upgrading their camera, because there wasn't changes in the camera. You know, there was no changes in technology. The autofocus would get a little faster, or they'd come out with the eye focus that Canon came out with, or there's, you know, all these little changes, but there just wasn't a reason to upgrade. And then when that digital camera boom happened and that the technology was changing so fast, and you went from that Mavica that 640 to 480, and then you went to a 1 megapixel camera. And I remember when that came out, that was a huge deal. You know, and the memory cards, same thing. Like, we'd have memory cards. I remember when the first 1 gigabyte memory card came out, we were all blown away. Like, you know, that was a giant memory card, because we're used to the, you know, the 32 megabyte memory cards and 64 megabyte memory cards. So it's amazing how much it's changed.
Yeah, we did just, you know, the first PC that I bought, I think it must have been in, when would it have been, 2000 or something, in 1999, roughly, very late 90s, early 2000s.
Yep.
That had a 16 megabyte hard disk. And yep, it seemed huge at the time. And now I create Photoshop files that are bigger than that.
Right.
It's just incredible.
It is amazing.
So whilst other photography shops have, or photography stores have, fallen by the wayside, how did you, like, what did Bedford do that was different from the competition that has allowed you to not only stick around, but expand? Because when I looked at your website, I realized that over the last decade, you've actually expanded your portfolio in terms of stores across three different states.
Multiple states, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of things. There's not one little thing that we've done. But, you know, the biggest thing when Stan Bedford, he was, and unfortunately he passed away in 2014 from Parkinson's disease at 60 years old. He was one of my big mentors. He's the one that hired me. And he was an amazing man in that he was a very Christian, Southern Baptist, black and white, right and wrong. He would not take a shortcut, would not, like, it, you know, he's doing it the right way. But also at the same point, one of the most intense businessmen that I've ever met. I remember when I went in and interviewed, I was in college and, you know, I was into photography and I was into golf. And so I went and applied for the photography job at Bedford's, and I went and applied at a golf shop. And I went and interviewed with both of them on the same day. I went home and talked to my girlfriend, who's now my wife, and said, man, that golf thing I feel pretty good about, but there's no way I'm getting that camera job. Because he just, I mean, it was like a 45-minute job interview, and he was grilling me. He's like, I don't care how much you know about photography. I want to know if you can sell. And I mean, just the man was super intense, but also like one of the best human beings that you could ever, you know, you could ever meet. And so his number one thing, and the big thing that he started the whole business on, and I know this is cliche these days, but the customer service that he offered and that he required out of all his associates was next level. Like, he was, you know, we have drive-through windows in most of our locations. Back then we had them in all of our locations, where if you wanted to go drop off a roll of film and it's raining or snowing outside, you go through the drive-through. You don't have to get out of your car. If you've got a baby in the car, whatever, drive-through window. Well, if there was two cars in that drive-through window, one person is waiting on the car that's at the window. He would be out. Mr. Stan Bedford, CEO of the company, would be running out the front door with the envelopes and a clipboard and making sure that the person behind him didn't have to wait any longer than they had to. Like, his customer service level was just amazing. So I think that mentality and that culture that he built helped us a lot. You talked earlier about, you know, all the competition everywhere and people coming in and playing the guitar and then going and buy it online because it's $20 cheaper. I think a lot of people came to us because they knew that whether they bought it from us or Best Buy or whatever, you know, they could come in and get great customer service from us. And so I think that they, you know, that was back in the day that the minimum advertised pricing stuff wasn't going on, where, you know, there's a good chance that Walmart was $50 cheaper on that Canon Rebel film camera. So we had to sell it. We had to sell the advantages that we had at Bedford's and why they should spend that extra $50 rather than go down the street to Walmart. So that's I think, is the number one thing, is just the level of customer service that we offer.
Because that's always the problem, isn't it?
Because, more,
so. Yeah, because in that world, it's impossible to compete on price. You know, that's the thing. There's always going to be somebody cheap.
It's actually way easier now than it was back then.
Okay.
Because Nikon and Canon and Sony and Apple and all these companies have these MAP programs where whether you buy a Nikon, you know, Z9 from Bedford Camera or B&H or Best Buy or any Nikon authorized dealer, it's going to be the exact same price within a couple of dollars. So when they came out with that, it actually made our job a lot easier. But back in the day, that was a huge deal.
What would you say was the greatest challenge over the last sort of 25 years or something? Was it to move from film camera to digital? Because I'm imagining that all of a sudden, all of the sort of film development, the lab part of that business must have fallen away.
It did.
Or was it the shift from point and shoot cameras to smartphones? What would you say
for us from a business standpoint? It was definitely the film to digital transition. From a profitability standpoint, now we were making way more gross dollars with digital than we ever made with film. But that film processing, it was just so profitable back then that it allowed us to be a lot healthier bottom line than selling digital cameras at 10% margin. They were both tough. I will say that. I mean, those were two very big transitional periods. And the first one was pretty early in my career. I was a salesman and assistant manager and that kind of stuff back in those days. So I wasn't privy to all the information probably. but it was, I know that there was, all those Process One labs that you see on every corner, like we were talking about, like Starbucks now, those all just went away. If you look at what happened in the drugstores, where they had two or three processing machines, and now most of them don't even have labs in them anymore. I mean, they're gone.
Yeah, interesting enough, over here in the UK, Costco was probably one of the last sort of chains that would still print in store.
Right.
And they've stopped doing that only recently, like within, I think, so for over the last 6 months or something, maybe over the last year, they stopped doing that. But up to that, up to then, you could still go into Costco and print your images. And I know a lot of like camera club guys who used to use Costco because actually the printer that they had was pretty good. I can't remember which one. Was it printer number 2 out of 3 that they had or something? And everybody would be like, when you go to Costco, make sure I print it on number 2 because, the other two
are crap. Yeah. They had one good machine and two bad ones. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, but that's gone now as well. So, we have this chain called Snappy Snaps.
Okay.
I was wondering who came up with that. But
good name.
Snappy Snaps. They used to do exactly, I mean, they're small stores. You find them on like high streets. They still exist. And they used to do predominantly like obviously film development, just like you mentioned earlier, you go to a drugstore like Boots. This is a chain over here in the UK, and you drop off your film, and I don't know, a week later or however long it took, you would then rock up and you'd get your prints back. And of course, that's all gone now. So all they do really nowadays is they sell sell picture frames. They do passport photos, and that sort of thing. That's what they don't really sell cameras, except I think they sell Fuji. The local one is a Fujifilm store, so they sell Fuji Instax cameras and film.
Yeah,
that's what they do. Not even any other Fuji products, just the Instax.
Right. Yeah, that's
so.
Yeah, and it's the same thing here. I mean, it went Walmart. So our corporate office in Northwest Arkansas is like 12 miles from Bentonville, Arkansas, which is the Walmart corporate office. And I don't know if Walmart's even over in the UK or what, but for us in the United States, that is the big chain of stores in the world, in the country. And so we're right there next to them. And so they've always been, it's always been tough to compete with that, right down the road.
Oh, absolutely.
But getting back to, other things that we've done to, not only survive, but expand, we got into the educational thing pretty early, where we discovered that if you did a camera class and you had 20 people come in and learn about shutter speeds and apertures and ISOs, within a couple of hours of this class, the relationship changed a little bit and it stopped becoming salesperson and customer and started becoming teacher and pupil. and they the level of trust that they would have for those instructors, you know, they're like, okay, this guy's just not trying to sell me something. He's teaching me how to do this. You know, the level of trust there helped a lot. So we've got now what we call BSI, which is Bedford School of Imaging. And we have all kinds of classes in all of our stores. We do a couple of big events every year, one in Oklahoma City and one in Little Rock, Arkansas, where we bring in all the big names, you know, some of the same names you've had on your podcast. We've had Moose Peterson in. The posters behind me are advertising some of those. We call the one in Oklahoma City, we call PhotoCon. And we bring in these world-renowned speakers, and we do like a weekend of, we bring in all the manufacturers. We have a great big trade show where we have deals on everything, and we have classes for three straight days, and we have photo walks at night, and we just do these great big things. And it creates so much energy and so much passion for photography. And that's the goal that we've taken, is the more people that we can get excited about photography, the better off we are as a company. Now we're probably giving a lot of business to our competition too. There's a lot of people that come to PhotoCon and then probably go buy something on B&H the next month or something. But the more people we can get excited about it, and the more people we can get interested in photography, you know, the better off we're going to be.
And I think, you know, that pathway into education is super important. And of course, it's also, to an extent, it's easier now than it's ever been, you know, with platforms like YouTube, for example, where, you know, you can you can create educational content and you can potentially reach an audience that you just couldn't have reached before that.
Yep. I remember when it was probably 2001 or 2002. I was a store manager at the time, and I was like, man, we need to do some classes. And so the first classes that Bedford's taught, at least in my, you know, within my career, it was still film days, you know, for the most part. So I was showing images on a slide projector and teaching stuff instead of like PowerPoint and all that. It was an actual slide projector. And, you know, I mean, it's just like you say, now you've got YouTube and we're able to put out great videos and educational content. Plus we're doing classes in the stores. For us, a big thing has been photo walks, where we go out and we'll take, you know, 20 to 50 photographers out. We do them on different days, like in Oklahoma City here, where we call it the third Thursday photo walk. So the third Thursday of every month, we go out and we'll sometimes bring Nikon in and they'll have some gear to, you know, to show. Sometimes we'll bring Canon in. Sometimes we'll just do it ourselves, and we'll do a model shoot one month, and then we'll go out and shoot wildflowers the next month. And then we'll do, you know, BMX bike racing the following month. So, and those are all 100% free. But again, it gets people excited about photography. It gets them to where we're not just salespeople anymore. Now we're friends and we're mentors and we're instructors.
And of course, I've seen you've also started running a YouTube channel with instructional videos and conversations and stuff. Yep. And, you know, that, are you planning on developing that more, or is that, what's your plan for that?
We are. We've got one person that kind of is in charge of that for our company, and it's growing, but it is definitely something that we're over. You know, if you look at the progression of our videos, we're doing way more now than we did 3 or 4 years ago. So we're definitely trying to ramp that up.
And so the YouTube thing is always, you always say it's a marathon, not a sprint. I can attest to that.
It is.
It's a very, very long marathon. You know, but
yes,
but it's just one of those things, you know, it eventually kicks in, and it's, you know, it works.
It does. And there's so much, you know, the other thing about YouTube is everybody's got a YouTube channel, and everybody's got, so it's really hard to break in and get, you know, because you search how to take pictures on YouTube or photography, you know, tips or whatever, we're going to be way down low, you know, I mean, there's a million of them. So you just keep having to throw stuff, you know, throw content at it. And, you know, it's weird because every once in a while, every 10th video, you know, you'll all of a sudden get a bunch of action on. So.
Exactly. And of course, you have the added advantage of, you know, already having built up a reputable brand. So that in itself, you know, we talked about creating trust earlier, that puts you, you know, to an advantage compared to, you know, some dude starting I was going to say start a podcast out of his living room, but that's
right.
But
yeah, for sure. It's, I mean, having a company name that's been in business for 50 years and that kind of stuff was, I mean, it's definitely a helper. The other thing that we did is we really embraced the website and the e-commerce side earlier than most of our competition. And when I say our competition, I'm not talking about the big box stores and the giant, you know, B&Hs of the world. I'm talking about photo specialty retail stores. And we embraced that, and we, you know, there's a company that does websites for most of the, or not most, a lot of the camera specialty stores in the country. And we didn't want our website to look like everybody else's website. So we hired a team to actually go and build a unique website. And it really actually helped us. You know, you talked about the COVID thing was when you kind of started this podcast. There was a lot of companies that when COVID hit, their web e-commerce was 2 or 3% of their overall sales. And they just weren't set up for volume and weren't set up, you know, I mean, they just didn't have that reputation. So when their walk-in traffic dried up, they were in trouble. And we had enough of a web presence, and we'd been pouring money into our e-commerce for 6 or 7 years before that, like really losing money on it, but just throwing more money at it. And so when COVID hit and all these people went online to buy stuff, like we were set up for that. And we actually did pretty well on our e-commerce side just because we, you know, finally all the fruits of those labors for the last 5 or 6 years kind of came to fruition on that one, you know, when COVID hit. So
that was definitely a pivotal point. I mean, it was really, for me as a photographer, it was a major pivot point, you know. And again, I've talked about this many times on this podcast, but it's basically, you know, I remember there was one particular day in March where my phone wouldn't stop ringing. It rang off the hook, and every call I took was a cancellation. Like every call was like, oh, sorry, you know, we used to shoot a lot of conferences at that time. It was like, oh yeah, no, that conference. Initially, you know, it was like, oh, we postponed it till the fall. And then eventually it was like, oh no, we're going to cancel it, you know, for 2020 entirely. And so I could just see my diary empty out. You know, it was like by the end of that day, I think there was nothing left in my diary. And I'm thinking, okay, this is like,
now what am I going to do? Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a scary time. I mean, we were not in near, you know, we're kind of in the central part of the United States in the Midwest, fairly conservative overall. So we definitely had the lockdowns and had all that stuff, but it was not near what some of the other areas of the country and areas of the world were. So I think we shut our stores down for like 5 weeks, but kept our e-commerce going that whole time. And basically back then I was the vice president, one of the vice presidents, the president at the time, and I basically loaded loaded trailers up full of inventory from all these stores and took it to our general office, you know, to where we had, because we didn't have staff in all these stores now. So we've moved all of our inventory to one central place where we could ship it out and do all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it was really a time where
wild times.
Yeah, it was wild. I mean, you had to really become, you know, you had to get creative. And I remember back in the day, you know, I used to do all sorts of different things that, I say it was a pivotal point because it did make me, first of all, it made me take a very different look, a much more, what's the word? Like a wide angle view of my own business. And it basically meant, you know, I realized that I had made this sort of typical mistake of literally putting all of my eggs into one basket. And, you know, although I would have never in a million years thought that there could be some kind of global event that would basically eradicate the conference market. I mean, you know,
right.
I didn't in a million years think that could even happen, right? I always thought like, oh, is this a pretty safe place to be, you know? But it happened, you know, it happened and it was all gone. And I realized that, you know, the fallacy was for me was that I built my business on one leg, so to say, you know, and when that broke, there was nothing else there to catch the fall. So I couldn't, you know, and I thought to myself, that is stupid. I've been a musician for such a long time and I've always done this thing of like creating a number of different, you know, pots like as a musician, you know, I used to do recordings, so I used to do sessions, I used to teach, I always play gigs, you know, and sometimes you had fewer gigs coming up, but you had more students, you know, so it would, everything would even itself out. And then maybe at one point you had fewer students, but you had more recording work going on. So, you know, but, and then I realized that for some stupid reason, I didn't follow that same principle in photography. Yeah. You know, it was just like, because I don't know, at the time, I think I thought like, oh, I've got to specialize, and I do this one thing and I got to do it super well. And then, of course, somebody pulled the rug from under my feet. And that was that. I was lucky.
Which truthfully wasn't a horrible business model, other than if something tragic happens. I mean, you know, if you're the conference photographer and everybody knows that that's what you do, I mean, that's a, you know, that can be a really good thing. But when all the conferences stop happening.
Yeah. And you know, it was a really good thing. It was a really good thing because my clients at the time were predominantly large international corporates, you know, big international firms that would basically run conferences in several locations around the world several times throughout the year. So actually, you know, in reality, I didn't need many clients. I just needed the right clients. And that's what kept me busy. But, you know, the problem is when you have like one client, you know, and you're shooting four or five conferences around the world for that client, and that client all of a sudden drops out, you're losing a massive chunk of your business right there, you know. And so the risk, as I've learned the hard way, the risk was quite high, you know. And the pandemic gave me the opportunity to reevaluate and really readjust or even adjust, you know, my business model, you know, to the point where, because I ended up doing things like this podcast, for example, which I didn't do before, you know, and what I do now is actually very, very different from what I did pre-pandemic. I mean, never in a million years would I have thought about a podcast. That's one thing, you know, or create content for YouTube or whatever. You know, I just didn't think that that was even a thing. Like, what, really? Right. Somebody pays you to make a video for YouTube? That's...
Yeah.
That's, is that even a thing? You know, but but yeah. So now I think, you know, when I speak to my photographer friends, and especially to my kids, right? Here's the thing. So when I talk to my kids about photography, the first thing that comes into their minds, and I say this because I actually believe that my kids are much more able photographers than I was at their age, because they spend half of their day, well, practically half of the day, taking pictures. They're just doing it with their smartphones and not with their cameras. And you know, when I talk to them about like cameras, they always say, look at me, and they go like, well, but I can just do it with my phone. Like, why would I carry a big camera around with me? How has that evolution, I don't know what to call it, a revolution, but that change to smartphone cameras, how has that affected the photography industry? Because I remember getting my first, I think it was a Nokia smartphone with a camera that was like sort of 1.2 megapixels or whatever. It was just basically, you know, you could take a better picture on a potato than you could on that phone.
Right.
Yeah. We've come a long way since then.
Yeah. Yeah. And really and that's what I kind of hit on it earlier with, it's kind of killed the point and shoot market. There are so many people that love the digital camera idea of being able to see the picture right as soon as you take it and send them and do all this stuff. And when, you know, when the phones got to the point that they were a good, acceptable picture, which truthfully for 97% of the population, what an iPhone can do is acceptable. What we've really started to see is the other 3%. So most of our clientele now, and there is an exception to this, but most of our clientele now are photographers. Whereas 10 years ago, when the digital camera boom was happening and everybody was buying point shoots, they weren't photographers. They were just people that were just coming in that just wanted a digital camera for the novelty of it. So now, instead of selling a $299 Nikon Coolpix, now we're selling, you know, a Sony A7R Mark V that's $3,500. So, and we're selling G Master lenses, and the stuff that we're selling is much more big ticket. And we're selling way less cameras than we were 10 years ago, but the average price point is significantly higher. Now, the change to that is, and you're talking about kids, and I'm glad you brought it up, there's been, and I'm sure you're seeing it over there too, but the kids now, it's kind of like the vinyl record thing. Like, they're super into film. And you mentioned the Fuji Instax earlier. But we are now processing again a significant amount of film. Not back like we were doing in the 90s, but, you know, like teenagers and 25-year-olds and, you know, that age range has really gotten back into the old school film cameras and taking pictures and getting their film developed. And, you know, I mean, that's become again a significant part of our business, which is pretty crazy. And I'm sure it's happened in the music thing too with vinyl, you know, same
company. Yeah, exactly. You know, and I was going to bring this up actually a little bit later, you know, the sort of revolution of film photography. It's super interesting to me because I'm of that generation. So I graduated from high school roughly about the same time as you, but I'm 94, 95, yeah, something like that. And you know, I grew up in a house in a family of photographers. I'm like a third generation photographer. My grandmother started the whole shebang back in the 30s, and then my dad carried it on. And you know, he turned our bathroom into a dog room. Nice. Through my entire childhood.
Which, there's a lot of those. There's a lot of those little dark room bathrooms.
Yeah, yeah, it was wild, you know. And I really remember the smell of chemicals and all the rest of it. And you know, at the time. Yeah. And again, something I've mentioned many times on this podcast. Yeah, at the time, I thought like, well, what's up with these old people, you know, shooting stills? Like, I want to make movies, you know, because it's the time of the Steven Spielbergs and, you know, Star Wars and Back to the Future and all the rest of it. You know, like, screw that, still photography. I want to make movies. And, you know, home video cameras became affordable. And all of a sudden, I could be like, you know, a bedroom filmmaker. That sounds wrong. Yep. A bedroom filmmaker, a hobby filmmaker. That's what I'm trying to say, you know. And that's what I did. And so, you know, and I went and that's what I did. Then I, you know, had a career in music, and then they got me. Somehow they got me. They got me to fall in line at some point. Yep. And then, you know, I joined the stills photography life when digital was firmly established. So, you know, personally, I don't actually really have that much experience with film and developing film and stuff like that. Right. And a couple of years ago, my middle daughter did her what we call A-levels over here in the UK. It's basically high school diploma type of thing. Mm-hmm. And she picked photography as her main master's course, whatever you call it, right? And first of all, I thought like, well, that's really interesting. And then I also thought like, I wonder what they actually teach on that course, right? And she had spent a lot of time shooting film and developing film. And I remember back then thinking, what's the point in that? Like, shouldn't they be like really getting into like Photoshop hard and, you know, all that kind of stuff? You know, retouching and yada, yada, yada. And of course, now that the pendulum has swung, and now that there's a real sort of resurgence of film, I'm just thinking, man, yeah, that would be fun to get into, but I know next to nothing about it, you know?
Right.
It's like, it really feels like the pendulum has swung the other way, all the way.
Yeah.
Which I find super exciting.
Yeah, and I don't know how long, you know, I don't know how long it's going to last or how long this fad or, you know, but I mean, it's very significant. It's been happening for a couple of years, and you know, they're into it, and they're wanting to do everything manual, and they like the excitement of, you know, they grew up in a digital phone world of instant gratification where you take a picture and you see it right there, you know. And so I think the not knowing is exciting to them. You know, they take that picture and have to wait for the film to get developed and have to take 24 or 36 exposures before they can turn the roll of film in. And, you know, it for whatever reason, they just, you know, it's become very popular. And same thing with like the Instax and the Polaroids and all that stuff is back popular too.
Yeah. And that's, I found myself getting into that a lot. Like I love the whole idea of Instax and Polaroids. In fact, I have a number of Instax cameras behind me. You can't see, but I find them super fun. It's great to be able to create a physical photograph on the fly. I use that in so many situations. Like one of the things I do, for example, is whenever I do a shoot, I would take an Instax of the crew, and that'll be the momentum for that particular shoot. And what I do in the rare event nowadays that I shoot a conference, but I usually do Instax portraits of some of the audio video crew that I work with, and.
Yep.
And I basically give them that almost like a business instead of a business card, but it's just something that's more interesting, you know.
I remember.
And it's got a sticker with my number on the back of it, so that you know they can. It's something you know if you have a cool little photo of yourself, like a cool little portrait, for example, you're much more likely to put it on the fridge.
Yeah, they're gonna remember where they got it. We used to do that a lot with. You know, we would go out, and this is back in the film days and stuff, but one of our marketing strategies was we would go, you know, we worked very, very closely with all of our communities. So if there was a Santa Claus shoot or there was a rodeo or there was, you know, we'd go out and take pictures and we'd say, hey, come into Bedford's, we'll give you a free picture, you know, with Santa Claus. And so, but we'd always put our logo on that picture, you know, before we printed them. So then they'd come in and, you know, we'd print 500 pictures up and 150 of those people would come in and pick them up. But those 150 people would go put that on the refrigerator for the next year. And our logo is right there front and center. So exactly. Kind of interesting. But I think that whole generation never grew up with physical prints in their hand. And I think that is cool to them. You know, before it's always on your phone or your computer or your, you know, Facebook or wherever, Instagram, you're seeing all these pictures. They see and take more pictures now than ever in the history of mankind.
Yeah.
But absolutely. Very few of them ever get to actually hold a picture, a photograph in their hand. And I think for a lot of them, that's a novelty now.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's so easy. Of course, it's so easy to shoot pictures. I mean, you know, I don't even know how many thousands, tens of thousands of images are on my iPhone right now. But of course, they're buried on my iPhone. I never really get to see them because there's just too many of them. And so I love this thing that, you know, Apple does, I'm sure Android does the same thing, I guess, you know, where you get this thing like on this day 2 years ago, you know, or like, you know, on your, what is it? It comes up with like, I don't know, you do it, you go on a trip, you know, and it'll be like Italy 2022. And then you get all these, this selection of images.
And Facebook does all of that too. Where they,
yes, exactly. Yeah, Facebook does the same thing. I love it.
Yeah,
it's awesome. Really good. I'm also slightly perplexed by how good the facial recognition is. Like, I don't know how Apple does it, but I mean, I have to say, like, my youngest daughter, for example, it will recognize that it's the same person. It'll go through like 10,000 images, and it will basically recognize that my daughter, who's like 12 now, and you look at a baby, then it'll basically say, like, well, this baby picture is also your daughter. And you're like, how the heck? That doesn't look anything like how? You know,
that's crazy.
It's crazy. But also super awesome because it means that, you know, when he comes up with this collection, you know, you're like, oh, yeah, that's really cool. And I forgot, you know, do you remember this? You know,
see the Halloween collection from.
It's amazing.
1 year old to 12 years old.
Yeah, it's, or like even like several months that he came up with. He came up with. So it added a picture to the collection the other day. That was the very first picture that I ever took of her when she was literally just born, and the midwife just put this bundle of baby in my arm and went like, here you go. And I was like, what the hell is this? Take a picture of it.
Yeah.
Like how it can figure out that is the same person, like the 12-year-old who is now, I don't know, skateboarding and, you know, wow. You know, it's just nuts.
It's a little spooky.
it's completely spooky. And that just brings me to my next question. I mean, we've talked about the changes in the past, but where is this going? Like, where do you see photography ending up in 5, 10 years, 20 years' time? Like, where is this going?
So, and that's I wish I knew the answer to that question. I feel like, you know, we talked about earlier back in the film days where you'd have a camera that came out every 3 or 4 years, 5 years, whatever, 10 years sometimes. And then the digital thing where they were every 6 months, they were coming out with a new model number because technology was changing so fast. And it feels like that is kind of slowing down a little bit again. You know, it feels like we're maybe in a trough of that now. The exception to that, and I'm not a huge expert on this by any means. I'm not really a lab guy. I'm not a Photoshop guy for the most part. But the AI thing could change a lot. But, you know, there's only so many megapixels you can pack into these cameras. There's only so much, so fast you can make the autofocus. There's only so much, you know, there was a pretty big transition with DSLR to mirrorless. But, you know, I just don't know. We've kind of come back now to where cameras are out for 3, 4, 5 years before they're replaced again, you know. And so it seems like that technology curve has slowed down a little bit, at least in the actual camera and lens department. But as far as where it's going 5, 10, 20 years from now, I mean, who knows? The way technology is changing and advancing, and I mean, we may be taking pictures with eye trigger, you know, who knows?
Well, yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that I think we can safely say is that people will always want to take images in one way or another.
Yes.
You know, that's the thing.
Well, if you think about it from back in the 1800s, you know, until now, I mean, there's obviously way more people, but that's always been something that everybody's interested in and something that everybody wants. You know, you want to preserve these memories. And like you say, you get memories from 5 years ago on Facebook or from Apple or whatever of your kid of an event that you'd kind of forgotten about. And it's a really cool thing to see that and to be able to look through your phone and see my son is a senior in high school. So he's about to graduate and be gone. And I can go back in my iPhone and scroll all the way to the top and see him as a 2-year-old, you know, singing me happy birthday. I mean, it's just,
yeah,
it's so cool. And you can't put a price tag on that. And that's what excites me about being in this industry. And that's one thing that Stan Bedford told me a long time ago. He's like, you know, you're not in the camera business. You're in the memory business. Like this is you're helping people to preserve their memories through video and through pictures. And, you know, I mean, that's a cool thing.
Absolutely. And they're exciting technologies that are coming out, like with Apple's recent, I forget what it's called, the headset thing. What is it called? Mm-hmm. I have no idea. If anybody remembers, you know, drop me a line. By the way, I have to let me quickly say this. You know, for those of you who watch this on YouTube, we're having a little bit of an issue with the internet speed today and the quality. But you know, stick with it. It's a super interesting conversation, and the audio is pretty good. So you know, perfect. So if you are listening on audio, you don't know what I'm talking about. Don't worry about it. I never said nothing. But anyway, but yeah. So you know, the technology, you know, as it's developing in the VR world, you know, could potentially be interesting because I'm thinking, like, for instance, you know, imagine you had a memory of, let's say, your child's first birthday party. And instead of it being a sort of two-dimensional video, what if it was more of a three-dimensional, you know, VR experience where you can actually,
right.
But imagine
go back and relive that experience.
Yeah. Well, what if it could be like a full-on three-dimensional experience where you could actually move around the character, like you could freely move in space. Like, how cool would that be? You know, where like you're not limited to the camera position, but you can actually move freely, almost like it's like holodeck. It's like Star Trek and the holodeck.
You know? And it's probably not that far away. You know, like my son has that Quest, you know, the VR Quest thing, and I look at that and he's like, hey, look at this boxing game, you know, and this big guy's coming at you ready to fight you. And you're, I mean, it's crazy how real that stuff is.
Yeah. It's
amazing. I mean, I could definitely see that, something like that happening.
So let me just ask you that one final question. If you look back retrospectively over the last 26 years that you've been a part of Bedford's and the photography industry, what would you say have been sort of the most rewarding aspects of that journey?
Well, there's a couple. The first one is, I mean, we've talked about it throughout this conversation, and it's kind of what the conversation is based on. But the way that this industry has changed so much in such a short amount of time, to be able to have lived through that and be able to say that when I came into the industry, it was almost all film, and then it went all digital, and now it's kind of come back a little bit. And, you know, it's just been a very exciting trip. And then the other thing is, again, just being in this industry and creating pictures and video and memories and watching people, you know, people that have been customers of mine for 25 years that come in and I've seen their entire life, you know, through their pictures. I've seen their vacation pictures, and I've seen their kids being born, and I've seen their kids growing up, and now their graduation pictures, and just being able to see that and share those memories with so many people has been very rewarding.
Phenomenal. Austin, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much for being our guest today on the Camera Shake podcast. Okay, folks, that's it for today. It was awesome having Austin on the show. And as always, before we go, let me just recommend another episode that I think you like. Check out episode 160 with Bure Perry, where we discuss how you can take better photos. I'm sure you love it. If you enjoy our content, consider supporting us on buymeacoffee.com/camera shake to help us continue creating and bring you more exciting episodes. It really does mean the world to us. And for those of you who are listening to the audio version of this podcast, did you know that there's a fully-fledged video version over on YouTube with plenty of examples of our guests' photography in full Technicolor? Well, all you have to do is go over to YouTube, search for Camera Shake Podcast, and you'll be able to watch all past episodes on there. And there's a lot of them in there. That was episode 194. So if you've seen this, if you made it to the end of this episode, you've got 193 other episodes that you can go and check out, which is amazing. Of course, if you're already on YouTube, well, then, you know, drop us a comment and hit the like button, ring that bell and share with your friends, because your engagement helps us reach a wider audience all over the world. Thank you for listening and watching. And remember, a new episode drops every Thursday. So mark that in your diaries. Until next time, keep shaking things up in the world of photography. See you next Thursday.